KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. On April 20th, 2010, an explosion on the Deepwater Horizon offshore drilling rig off of the U.S.'s Gulf Coast killed 11 crew members and caused the largest marine oil spill in history. The rig was leased by the transnational oil company BP, and the explosion was linked to a combination of corporate negligence and lax federal government oversight. After spending tens of billions of dollars in cleanup around the Louisiana coastline, has the industry or government learned the right lessons? The Deepwater Horizon anniversary also comes at a historic moment for the oil and gas sector, as the economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic led to fossil fuel prices plummeting to negative values this week. My guest is Antonia Juhas. She's a leading energy analyst, author, and investigative journalist. She's the award-winning writer who's contributed to Newsweek, Rolling Stone, Harper's Magazine, The Atlantic, CNN.com, The Nation, Ms. Magazine, The Advocate, and more. And she's the author of several books, including The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It, and Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Welcome to the program, Antonia.
Thank you for having me, Sonali. Great to be with you.
So you were one of the journalists on the front lines after the BP Horizon, Deepwater Horizon oil spill took place 10 years ago. And for those who might be too young to remember or whose memories have faded, how do you put that environmental disaster into context? I mean, I mentioned that it was the biggest marine oil spill in history, but that, of course, doesn't capture everything.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's important to say basically we have just passed the 10-year anniversary of the start of the disaster, and that was a blowout at BP's Macondo oil well in the Gulf of Mexico that sent natural gas and oil shooting up into the Deepwater Horizon oil rig. When the natural gas hit the rig, it sparked a series of explosions that blew up the rig. It killed 11 men. And then it unleashed this torrent of oil that was released out of the ocean floor for more than 3 months' time, 200 million gallons of oil. And as you say, the largest, largest offshore drilling oil spill in history. And it's important to say that April 20th was the start of the disaster 2010, but that was only the beginning. It then unleashed a cascading effect of oil, chemical dispersant impacts that impacted human health, that impacted the Gulf ecosystem, that impacted the economy of the Gulf South, and continue to have ripple effects to this day. And I think it's important to continue to discuss this as an ongoing disaster, that there have been some restoration to those impacts, but a lot of it continues to be ongoing, including the ongoing threat that it could be repeated again.
So a big part of the issue, I understand, was federal government oversight was completely lax. The whole point of government regulation is to ensure that private businesses, private corporations follow the rules so that we don't have accidents such as this. Since the accident happened 10 years ago, has there been any improvement to federal government oversight?
Well, so I guess the first thing I would say is, so I wrote a book, Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. I specifically didn't name BP in the title because I wanted it to be clear that this was an industry-wide failure and a government failure. And yes, it was certainly an accident to the extent that nobody wanted this to happen, but it was certainly predictable and predicted that it would happen. The entire industry lied to the American public, lied to federal regulators about its capacity to prepare for, handle, and mitigate an offshore oil spill, even though it was continually told this is likely, because the industry kept pushing out and continues to deeper and deeper and deeper into much greater depths of drilling, much farther from the shore, beyond its technological capacity to do the work, and certainly well beyond its capacity to address a spill. Regulators allowed them to do this. regulators also were just outgunned by the industry. We have chronically underfunded regulation in this nation and undervalued it. That has worsened, and the regulators were not able to oversee the expansion of what was happening in the industry and continues to, and were not able to keep up technologically with what was happening. And so there was insufficient regulation and a willingness to let the industry really regulate itself, which it didn't do and hasn't done. So it was a failure on both parts, from the side of the government regulators, but I would say even more profoundly, a failure of an industry that was told that it could and should essentially regulate itself and given the keys to this incredibly dangerous and destructive set of operations. And even most recently, I was on a call on Monday to commemorate the disaster. And one of the workers who had worked on the rig, Leo Linder, he was a mud engineer on the rig, he described offshore oil drilling as inherently risky and inherently dangerous, and said that the lesson that he learned is that we need to get off of oil as rapidly as possible and not be willing to accept so much death and sacrifice to continue to feed our consumption of oil.
So there were 11 lives lost 10 years ago, and that's something we don't hear enough about. But also, in addition to that, the devastating impact to the environment and, as you said, the economy. Setting aside those lives that can never, be returned, has the economy restored itself? Has the environment, has marine life been, restored to the point where it is at least as good as it was 10 years ago?
Certainly not where it was 10 years ago. This is referred to as an ecosystem collapse of the Gulf of Mexico, and that is what happened. I had one of the incredible opportunities I had in reporting on this devastating event was to join Dr. Samantha Joy many years ago in a submersible, and we went down to a mile below the ocean surface to the site of the Macondo well where the disaster took place. And what Dr. Samantha Joy has been recording is how 30 million gallons of the oil that was released has remained in the ocean ecosystem, at least half of that settling on the ocean floor. So what that means is that the entire ecosystem has this preponderance of oil, much of which still remains. And so from the very bottom, the most benthic species, the tiniest microorganisms who have seen harm caused to them and their survival due to their ingestion of this oil and the chemical dispersant, that has then trickled up the food system. So the bottom of the ocean was impacted in many ways the most, and that's where many of the species that then provide life to the rest of the ecosystem reside. So the phytoplankton that feeds on those microorganisms, the fish that feed on the phytoplankton, the birds that feed on the fish, all of which have been impacted. And so there is a death toll that continues through species-wide. There is also recovery that has happened. And so one of the outcomes of the disaster was a great effort on the part of Gulf South communities to push for something called the Restore Act, which required that $4.5 billion of the federal government settlement with BP went to state level restoration. And there have been good projects that have happened with that money. The problem is, even though, comparatively to other places in the world, a great deal of money did come from BP, did come out to states, it just isn't nearly enough to address the scope of the damage that took place. So looking at the economy, for example, oysters, crabs, the sort of route that provide jobs to fisher folk across the region are still not where they were at the time of the disaster.
I want to switch to where the oil and gas industry is today. So we have the situation where oil and gas prices were already low because we've had a glut, because there's just more supply than demand. And then the coronavirus pandemic hit, and traffic in cities around the country, transportation slowed dramatically. Oil and gas prices fell. They fell so hard, that this week, I didn't know this was possible, but this week they went negative. What does this mean for where the industry is right now?
So one thing I'll say really quickly to sort of bridge the two topics is that one of the most important things that hasn't happened in the US Gulf of Mexico is one, there has not been a slow in production. Instead, there's been an increase in production. And two, the Obama administration did put in some new regulations to make offshore drilling sort of that much safer. And those limited regulations that the Obama administration put in were removed by the Trump administration. On top of that, since the COVID-19 epidemic began, the Trump administration has eased regulations across the board on polluters, including reporting requirements that affect the oil and gas industry. So reporting of oil spills in the Gulf of Mexico just since March has declined by 40% from last year. So that means we don't know by probably a factor of 40% or more how much more oil is being released into the Gulf of Mexico because production has continued. So as you say, basically the industry this week faced the lowest prices for oil in the United States in at least 100 years. This is a complete crash of the price of oil. Producers are paying buyers to take oil from them. That is
Wow.
because there is just way too much product. So there was already before this happened, way too much product of oil being produced. I mean, see, even before COVID-19 hit, a glut of oil, producers producing way too much of a product that the world is trying really hard to get off of. As a result of that, in the United States in particular, a huge segment of the US fracking industry was in debt to the tune of $200 billion before COVID-19. So this was an industry in crisis because it's producing a product that people just don't want that much anymore. Enter COVID-19, demand collapses, but they keep producing. So demand is down, production essentially remains steady. And so we face this huge glut of oil. There's no one who wants it, and now there's nowhere to put it. Storage is drying up. So then this month, traders who really define the price of oil way more than OPEC or anyone else, traders suddenly had to match their futures trading contracts with having to actually supply oil on the ground. Nobody wanted the oil, and they had to pay to unload it. That's the situation that we're in now, a just completely broken industry that was broken before COVID-19 and has now been, deeply crippled as a result.
So early on in the pandemic, the Trump administration did its level best to bail out the industry. They basically bought up to fill up their Federal Reserves, I understand. And Trump has already announced, since the price has dropped to negative, that he will be rescuing the industry. What specifically has the federal government done, and as far as you know, plans to do at a time when, millions of Americans are unemployed and are staggering from the crisis, not sure how to pay rent or buy food even? Trump is promising to bail out this incredibly destructive and incredibly wealthy industry, even though part of it might be in debt.
So first of all, the Trump administration proposed spending $20 billion on buying up oil, filling up the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and really the Democrats in Congress stopped that. So that didn't happen. Trump has continually put forward ideas in this, particularly addressing the oil market, both internationally and nationally, and a lot of it hasn't happened. So there's a lot of talk and not a lot of action. And I think that's because he's really torn between three key parties. He's aligned with Russia and Saudi Arabia internationally. He's aligned with domestic frackers domestically, and he's not really partnered with big oil companies. But domestic frackers in the United States are in opposition to Saudi Arabia and Russia. Big oil is in opposition to domestic frackers, and Trump is kind of caught in the middle. What he tweeted was that he is going to move forward on a bailout for the US oil industry. Now, it looked like that was already headed in that direction following the airline bailout. And just to make this connection, the massive bailout of the US airline industry, what's happening is we are paying airlines, we are forcing airlines, in fact, to continue to fly as much as they were before COVID-19, even though ridership is down about 90%.
And
So
then
they're
that's and of course, this is an industry that is a huge consumer of oil and gas.
Precisely. So I think that's one of the main reasons why they're being told to keep flying, is because they are the sort of lone consumer of jet fuel, which is obviously a fossil fuel product. So I think that's one of the reasons why that's happening. But now it looks like what the industry is asking for is, remember that $200 billion debt I mentioned that the fracking industry was already suffering under?
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
asking for the federal government to buy that debt. So we would pay to pay off a debt that was incurred because they were producing too much of a product that destroys our climate and that we don't want. So that bailout, which will also, if it falls, the airline industry bailout would be grants, not loans. So we would, I guess, be giving this money to the industry, is a really bad idea. I think a really good idea is one where, instead of propping up an industry that was already failing, put in a great deal of money to support workers in that industry to transition rapidly to a green energy economy, and to pay producers to start keeping their oil in the ground so that we don't have this entire collapse of an industry, and invest money into transitioning as rapidly as possible into green energy while essentially implementing what's called a managed decline of oil production. Anywhere that can go first in keeping its oil in the ground does. And we help support that financially to make sure that it can happen now.
So this, essentially, this bailout that's being proposed of the oil and gas industry, this is taxpayer money. This is money that we are told is never available for things like Medicare for All or for a Green New Deal, but always readily available to bail out an already wealthy industry that is so destructive, that really has no future, but is hell-bent on surviving. You know, we've completely pushed aside all fears of climate change, it seems. Not that Trump was ever a believer that that was real, but, you know, if the coronavirus pandemic caught us off guard, isn't catastrophic climate change going to do something similar?
I mean, absolutely. I think that, you know, this is obviously incredibly short-sighted. I do think it's important, though, to recognize how deeply intertwined right now the global economy is to oil. And what I'm really worried about right now are poor producing nations and poor producing areas of the country, areas of the country that are poor, producing nations that are poor. So what we're seeing is basically the inverse of what happened in 2008, when the price of oil shot up to $150 a barrel. And that, I believe, was the most significant contributor to the global financial collapse, because consumer countries couldn't afford that. Now producer, we're on the opposite side of the spectrum. Producer countries are now gonna be in big trouble. So we have to look at how to shift the entire globe financially off of oil as quickly as possible. And luckily, we already have the structures for that. The Paris Climate Agreement put in place a system where wealthy countries were to pay poor countries to transition off of oil. That just has to happen much more rapidly. And we have to think about essentially paying those places in our country and those places internationally that are currently dependent on oil to prop them up as they essentially move as rapidly as possible to a green energy economy. If we don't, what's already being called the COVID crash, which is the recession we're already in, will be made much worse by an oil crash as well. And that, again, just highlights the necessity that to take this opportunity to get off of this incredibly volatile resource. We've been being tossed around by oil markets, particularly for the last 20 years, since futures trading was deregulated in 2000. And that volatility is dangerous. That volatility could threaten any recovery from this economic collapse. And there is an answer. We just don't need to be dependent on this resource anymore.
Circling back, Antonia, to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill that started 10 years ago, what is the status of offshore oil drilling, especially under Trump? We have, as we've said, a glut of product that nobody wants right now. You know, at that same time, are we drilling deeper and deeper? Are we continuing the existing drilling and starting new projects?
Absolutely. And so one of the things that the Trump administration does have an energy policy, and that policy is American energy dominance, as opposed to what preceded it, which was generations of trying to find American energy independence. This administration has sought dominance, and in many respects, it's achieved that, joining Russia and Saudi Arabia as the three most dominant players on the global oil scene. And that's because the Trump administration has ramped up production everywhere to the highest levels seen in U.S. history and has deregulated aggressively. So regulations that were put in place under the Obama administration are gone. Money that went to these agencies for oversight has been redirected. And there's been an aggressive deregulatory push by this administration. So more production everywhere, less regulation. And that's also true for the offshore area. What's interesting, though, is that the Trump administration had initially proposed a 5-year offshore drilling plan that was going to open up offshore drilling everywhere in the United States. States pushed back hard against that, and essentially the Trump administration was forced to take it off the table. So offshore drilling in the Pacific, offshore drilling in the Atlantic, offshore drilling in protected areas in the Arctic, that essentially has not happened. So what that tells me is that the American public still is already willing, and government officials are willing, to draw a line where there are places where we don't want to drill. And I think what that means is the willingness is also there just to dial back oil production. There's a strong desire to shift to green energy, and that just has to be pushed for right now. And I think the Democrats in Congress have an immense opportunity right now to say no to a bailout and to say yes to policies that have been embraced by Americans for decades, which is that there are places and times where we don't drill, and to continue that effort. I think what has definitely happened since the Trump administration took office is we know less about what's happening in offshore drilling. There's less reporting, less transparency, and the companies have continued to push deeper into more dangerous parts of the Gulf of Mexico, where they're still drilling aggressively, and they've continued production. I think the industry, the sort of good news was that during the Obama administration, as I said, there were some regulations put in place that made offshore drilling safer. And when the industry knew that those regulations were coming, they began operating more safely, and blowouts in the Gulf of Mexico essentially went down to zero in 2016. As I said, those regulations were then lifted by the Trump administration, but we also don't have new data on how many blowouts have happened as a result. But we do know that oil spills, reported oil spills, increased in 2018 by 40% over the previous year. So we've got more drilling, and the risk of a deep water horizon sized disaster definitely still looming.
Finally, Antonia, we may have a new administration next year. What is your assessment of a potential Biden presidency on the oil and gas sector? Would he go back to the Obama administration status quo of adopting the Paris Accord, or go even further than that? I cannot imagine Biden would actually embrace a deal as progressive as the Green New Deal, but at least could we come back to a slightly less extreme position than we are in now?
I'm sure it would be less extreme, for sure. I think that, Biden, over the course of the campaign, was certainly, pretty much the most conservative of the candidates when it came to taking aggressive action on fossil fuels. But even being the most conservative of the Democratic candidates is nothing like the Trump administration. Just to put some of it in context, the Trump administration is made up of people who have made a living off of working for the industry and trying to deregulate the industry as much as possible, and people who may in fact be profiting off of the situation right now. So Wilbur Ross, U.S. Commerce Secretary, had or has, it's unclear that he's not been transparent on whether he's divested from these companies, but he had or has major holdings in two shipping companies who they're, what those shipping companies do is take oil, put it into tankers, and ship it around the world where it just floats around until traders have decided that they can make more money selling it. And that's exactly what's happening with all the oil right now. And Trump keeps talking about this right now. We can put the oil into tankers and ship it around the ocean. Well, it just so happens that his commerce secretary does that for a living. That's the administration that we're talking about. A Biden administration, so Biden has gone further in this campaign than he had previously in sort of designating areas as no-go. So he said that he wouldn't do any new leasing in federal offshore waters. And he also said that he wouldn't do new leasing in federal lands. He took a no fossil fuel money pledge. He would not embrace the Green New Deal, as you said, but I think that he has tried very hard to court Sanders and Warren supporters, and I think that that's going to have an effect of pushing his positions to more aggressively tackle the climate crisis by addressing fossil fuels. And I think that's just going to be a matter of how much he's pushed as the election proceeds to see that that is the will, that is the position of the majority of Democrats and probably the majority of the American population, is that what they want, that's what they want, and that he's going to have to embrace positions that put that into play.
Antonio, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, for sharing your expertise on this issue. Really appreciate all your work.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
My guest has been Antonia Juhas. She's a leading energy analyst, author, and investigative journalist, and author of several books, including The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It, and Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. We've been discussing the 10th anniversary of the BP disaster, as well as the current state of the oil and gas sector. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.